Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with poet Roger Kamenetz and painter Michael Hafka, whose new collaboration is a book called To Die Next to You. We'll also talk with Baton Rouge native Tim Parrish, who has two new books out, the memoir Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, and a novel, The Jumper. And we'll catch up with photographer Richard Sexton and writer Randolph Delahanty, celebrating the 20th anniversary of their book, New Orleans, Elegance and Decadence. Poet and dream worker Roger Kamenetz is back with a new book, a collaboration with American Expressionist painter Michael Hafka, called To Die Next to You. And it is simply gorgeous. Roger is here in the studio with us to talk about it, and we'll be talking with Michael Hafka from his home in Brooklyn. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Great. And hello again, Roger.
Hey, hi, Michael. Hi, Susan.
Now, this is a collaboration that took place over a considerable length of time. How did you two meet and get this underway?
We met on Facebook. I think Michael sent me something about the last book I published, Burnt Books. And we started talking on Facebook, and it turned out we had a lot of interest in dreams. And we sent each other all of our books and began reading each other. And I looked at a lot of Michael's paintings. He had a catalog from a museum show. And so, I don't know, just...
I love Burnt Book and the dream book Roger wrote, and I wrote Conscious Unconscious. So we really connected on that level, and then I really wanted to paint Roger. So that's when we finally met.
That's right. He coated me with paint. I mean, actually, I came to his studio and...
There's a lot of complexity to the painting of you.
There is a lot, because it doesn't look like me.
Oh!
But it does. I mean, it's one of those... It reminded me of... Picasso painted Gertrude Stein, and she said, it didn't look like me, and he said, it will. And I think Michael's painting is going to look like me, and it's kind of an amazing painting, but that's the way Michael works. He's always putting on several layers of reality underneath and over, and you can feel that complexity in the work he did with this book.
So how long have you all been working together in this way?
Must be 3 years, right, Michael?
I think actually four. It's been quite a while.
Now, Michael, when you were painting, you listened to the poems. Would you talk about what that was like?
Oh, that was a fabulous experience. Actually, you really want to be in the poem as you're drawing. So I asked my wife, Yannat, who's also a poet, to read the poems to me. And she would read them over and over, and they sort of became like chants as I was drawing the drawings. So I'm very grateful to her for reading them, and she read them beautifully.
So was this like a meditation for you as you were painting?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, painting itself is kind of like a meditation. And actually, the amazing thing of doing this, a thing like this, is that you're meditating in a more free way because it's another person's mind that's guiding you. So in a sense, you achieve mindlessness by default. It's kind of a bit of luck. It's Roger's words going through my head, floating me into spaces that Roger imagined.
Wow.
It's as if I visited Roger's dream.
Oh, incredible. And then, Roger, how did that work for you when you saw the paintings? Did you see them in progress or just as they were?
Oh, yeah. Every time Michael finished one of the works, he'd send me a JPEG and I'd just be knocked out. It was so amazing. And at first I thought, well, these are illustrations of the poems. But then I started thinking, well, really, the poems are commentaries on the drawings. And I really got kind of in that space, too, which is outside of time. Michael would see things the way he works. Is very intuitive, but he would seize on something in the poems and bring them into gestures in the works that are just amazing, so that I sort of feel like you have to read them both together now, like the poems are reading the paintings and the paintings are reading the poems, and as a reader you get to participate in all that.
Right. Now, what kind of energy did you feel coming to you from these poems, Michael? I think a lot of them are very dark and very sad and yet uplifting in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really can't define what kind of energy I felt, except that I really felt close to the poems, as if I had written them. And actually, the magic of this book is that I don't see a separation between me and Roger. I can't write poetry, but it's as if I wrote poetry and imagined, you know, you could have the illusion, these are my poems, as Yanat was reading to me, they were words in my head, so I didn't even separate anymore. So, you know, the energy was mine, actually.
That's really lovely. So, Roger, you were going to read one for us and give us a sense of what To Die Next to You is all about.
Well, Susan, I'd like to read a poem called An Old Explosion of the Sun, and then I'd like to say a little bit about the picture, too. The tired work of hydrogen, sigh of helium, simple elements grow heavy in the sun. We were asked to enter love where the door is all burning, every inch of skin, tiny hairs, lit up and freed. For whoever joins the helium will find how heaven burns, the god of light and fire. I caught your eye, I signed to you with my burnt hand. It vanished in the gesture like the memory of a dream. I saw you moving deeper, your eyes, how your seeing made a darkness like tunnels through the light. The immense fire that burns the heart of everywhere did not spare your memory or memory's ice. And if I traveled through the darkness, you sent me as a guide. Would you meet me where the burning makes new light for the sun? So I think this poem is about love and pain, you know, the god of love and pain, and the image of one of the partners traveling into the sun and the other following, and this sort of reversal of dark and light so that the vision of the lover creates tunnels of darkness in the light. And I think it speaks to the place in relationship where love and pain are really the same thing, which is something I've kind of learned from working with dreams. Michael's image, which of course you can see over the radio, is really, for me, an incredible image because he has an image kind of the sun in the background, and there's this figure who is burnt in one sense, and he uses some sort of black inks to make that happen. But at the same time, the gesture, which Michael's so amazing with the gestures of bodies, is kind of rising up, and he almost is turning into a bird. So you talked about the darkness and the lifting, and that's both happening, I think, in the poem and in the drawing.
And there's such energy in the drawing. You can feel it, I mean, when you look at it.
Yeah.
So what is it like for you to hear Roger read that poem, Michael?
Well, it was very, very beautiful. And with this poem, I felt it very much about love, but very much about the birth of one single self. I mean, there's no possibility of love without the two people, but it has to be born in a single person. And so sort of the whole poem is the internalization of love that one can bring to someone else and bring to the universe. It really amazed me to hear him read it because it sounded exactly like that to me.
We've been talking with painter Michael Hafka and poet Roger Kamenetz, creators of the new book, To Die Next to You. Thank you both.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
Baton Rouge native Tim Parrish made his debut with the short story collection Red Stick Men in 2000, so it's been a while since we've heard from him. But he's back to reward readers with two books this year, a novel called The Jumper and a memoir called Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist. We're speaking to Tim from his home in New Haven, Connecticut, where he teaches writing at the University of Southern Connecticut. Welcome to The Reading Life, Tim.
Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
I'm great. I have to tell you, these two books really pack a punch. Let's start with the memoir, Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist. This must have been a really difficult and painful book to write.
Yeah, frankly, it was awful. I mean, if I had to choose whether or not to do it again, I would try to choose not to do it. But as I talk about in the prologue to the book, I didn't really choose to do it the first time. It's the only thing I've ever felt truly compelled to write. But yeah, it's, living with that material and dredging it up for 7 years was pretty nightmarish.
Yeah. Set the scene for the reader. It's Baton Rouge, you're a teenager, a family with strong religious views, changing times in schools and works and churches.
Right. I was born in 58, and the book basically covers the first 17 years of my life and really focuses more microscopically on the 3 years of high school, I guess. But I was raised in a fundamentalist Southern Baptist family, and I was in an environment that was extremely racist growing up. and also very focused on the book of Revelation in this sense that the apocalypse was looming and there was a kind of, you know, fetishistic desire for it to happen. So I had this upbringing that really focused me on a kind of us against them mentality. And then when I was about 12 years old, things started to go haywire. My brother went to Vietnam and some other bad things happened around the house. And then I got in this kind of horrific street fight and almost got killed and then was stalked for a while. And that just really put a kind of fear in my bones. And like a lot of people, I think, did after 9/11, we may or may not get to that connection. I thought that if I allied myself with a violent, charismatic brute, that I would be better off and safer, and of course, that never works out. So that's kind of the sketch of the thing.
Well, so much of it is about violence. It really is difficult to read. It takes you really right back to that time. So did you feel that you had to get away from the South to write this book? Did you have a sense of urgency about moving away?
I didn't. I went to grad school at the University of Alabama, so I was actually at Alabama longer than I was at LSU, which was kind of a betrayal. And I still can't really root for Alabama despite that. But I didn't feel any need to get away from the region. I just got a job up here, and that's why I moved up here. Having said that, I think that being here really allowed me to get a kind of perspective I never would have gotten in the South. So I think you're on to that.
So what did writing this book do for you? How do you feel now that you finished it?
I have a lot of mixed feelings, mostly right now, about coming home. I'm coming to New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and Lafayette. And so, you know, obviously it's tricky and it's very rife to have written about my family in a way that some of them feel very exposed. But I feel like I've treated them fairly and I felt like I, you know, had to write this book. But on the other hand, because I felt like I had to write the book, I feel a great sense of relief, and I think that I told a story that I certainly needed to tell for myself, and I feel like already has been valuable to some other people who've contacted me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have some ambivalence about it, but I'm glad I did it, and I'm going to work with and talk to people who may think that it wasn't the right thing to do.
So much of what I love about your work is the way you capture the spookiness of this Gulf Coast landscape. You know, that eerie glow of the refinery lights, the way we're always looking for smoke and explosions. And it is kind of an apocalyptic landscape, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And as I think I talked about it in Red Stigman as well, I think it saturates my books because it was my experience at night lying in my bed when I was a kid. I could actually see the fires on the horizon and hear this kind of woofing sound when the flare stacks would spit out some flame and then they'd suck air back in. So it really was. I mean, it tied in directly with what I was hearing at church every week about the apocalyptic ending. And for a kid, it was actually pretty cool. I mean.
But then, let's move on to The Jumper a bit.
Okay.
This is such an interesting novel. It's about a young man who's been isolated from his family, from his own history, and he's suddenly thrown back into it. So talk about the process of writing these two books. I guess you were doing it kind of side by side?
Well, I actually wrote The Jumper right after Red Stick Men. I shopped it around through an agent who had wooed me, which was sort of shocking in the first place. And then things kind of fell apart in that whole process. But the bottom line is I had that book finished in 2005, and then I just pulled it out of circulation. I got kind of demoralized at writing it. And about a year and a half ago, I found out about this Texas Review contest, and I revisited the book, and I completely rewrote it during a school year, which is not something I would advise somebody to do. And I completely rewrote it twice.
Wow.
And submitted it to the contest and fortunately won. And I think the good part of that was I think I finally saw the book. I'd been away from it for 6 years.
Right.
I wouldn't advise anyone to go through that. But I really feel like it's a much better novel than it was originally.
Well, one of the amazing things about The Jumper is the way it captures that painful isolation of illiteracy. Jimmy can't read, and you really make us see the world through his eyes in all its blankness and terror and the ways he tries to cope. How did you kind of shut down that literate part of yourself to do this?
Well, my first teaching gig was developmental reading at LSU, and my first master's degree was in secondary reading education. So I actually worked really closely with people who were not only struggling, but actually some people who were functionally illiterate. And then the man on which the novel is based couldn't read at all, and I tutored him for about 7 months. and I won't give away the details of that because it plays into the plot of the novel. But,
right.
You know, I had a lot of experience, but it was really interesting to just imagine the details of not being able to read in day-to-day life. So it was kind of a step of imagination. I won't say a leap.
Well, you've certainly found your material in Baton Rouge, I tell you. So.
Or it found me.
I know.
It hasn't let go yet.
Oh, no, I hope it doesn't. Well, we've been talking with Tim Parrish, the author of two new books, Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, and the novel, The Jumper. You can meet him at Octavia Books Thursday, October 10th at 6 p.m. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you, Susan. Look forward to seeing you.
You bet. It's a bit unusual to celebrate the birthday of a book, but that's just how we roll in New Orleans. New Orleans, Elegance and Decadence by photographer Richard Sexton and writer Randolph Delahanty is marking its 20th anniversary this year. Published in 1993, it captured a particular part of the essence of our city, providing a catchphrase for interior design and so much else. It was easy to shrug and say, well, Elegance and Decadence. Here today to talk with me about their book are Richard Sexton and Randolph Delahanty. Welcome back, Richard.
Yes, thanks for having us.
And welcome back to New Orleans,
Thank
Randy.
Thank you, Susan.
So remind me how you two worked on this book, how you came up with this project initially.
We originally did a book together on San Francisco Victorian architecture and enjoyed working together and produced an unusual and still, I think, the best book on the subject. And then Richard moved to New Orleans. And at that point,
I definitely owed him a project. So that became the basis for the collaboration for New Orleans Elegance and Decadence.
And like everyone who moves to New Orleans, you want everybody else to come with you, you know? Sometimes that happens.
And that is what happened for a while. Yes.
And after it was published 20 years ago, had it, do you think, achieved your hopes for it?
I think I can speak for both of us that we were thrilled with the reception that it received initially, because whenever you do a book about a place and the people in a place, if they like it, that's kind of one of the best litmus tests there is. And the fact that New Orleanians responded so positively to this book, that was the most gratifying thing to me personally anyway.
And this is a city with many ups and downs, mm-hmm. Many downs, maybe more than ups. And this book came at a moment when I think New Orleanians wanted to be appreciated. They wanted to see their culture understood and showcased in a positive way. And this book did that. And I feel that both Richard and I have been very gratified by the way the people who live here have responded to the book. I think they found something that was essential to the culture, visually, in literature, in history, in gardening, in just the whole atmosphere of the place. And I think people like to be appreciated and understood, and this book did that.
So let's talk about that phrase, elegance and decadence. Mm-hmm. Where did it come from?
Well, I'll tell you one kind of funny story is the original working title for the proposal that I put together to submit to Chronicle was The Elegance of Decay. Now, Randy's father was a dentist, and he did not like the idea of decay in the title, as that was just kind of the wrong inference.
Also, it wasn't French enough. Decadence has a kind of ring to it.
Yes, so ultimately,
decay doesn't.
Ultimately became Elegance and Decadence. It expresses something about New Orleans, and at the same time, there's sort of a dichotomy there, a bifurcation. You've got the two things. Sometimes they merge together in a strange way. Sometimes they're distinctly apart. But it just seemed to be a very good way to describe this character of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Also, in the French literary culture, there is a thing called décadence, and it is a movement in French poetry and writing. And I feel that that is conveyed to some degree in the cultural attitudes and values of the people who live here.
Right. Yes. I think so, too.
And one thing that I could add, too, about that, that sort of the proof is in the pudding in terms of the photography. I think this is the first book that anybody ever did that has a bathroom in the Bywater on the cover. And it also has a hallway in the Bywater on the back cover. So right off the bat, you get the impression that maybe this book's going to be a little bit different.
Exactly.
And I think that this was prescient, particularly on Richard's part, to investigate the parts of New Orleans that really at this point had not been looked at in a culturally serious way. Now, New Orleanians know the division between uptown and downtown and Riverside and Lakeside and all of the fine gradations of this place. And most of the books previous to our book, Elegance and Decadence, had been about uptown. And they had been about the mansions in the Garden District or in the University District. And we looked at a different part of New Orleans, and it actually, if you look at New Orleans today, the revivification of places like Bywater and St. Claude and that whole part of the city that had been forgotten, the book was in a way prescient that this would be the next part of New Orleans to be appreciated and discovered.
Absolutely. That was one of the things that struck me the most looking through it again last night. It's Bywater, you know, yeah. All these houses, yes, in the Bywater.
Yes.
It's so interesting. So what have you two done since then? I mean, Richard, I really want to hear about the Creole world. I know that's
okay.
Coming soon.
Well, that's the latest thing, and it'll be out next spring. But I couldn't have been more fortunate to do a book like Elegance and Decadence, because that led to many other projects. Vetches of Grandeur was a book on the River Road, which came out a few years later. I also did the photography for Lake Douglas and Jeanette Hardy's book, Gardens of New Orleans, and just finished a book the last time I was here, New Roads and Old Rivers on Point Coupee Parish. So there have been many things, but the next thing coming down the pike, it's an interweaving of my New Orleans photographs, both old and some new, in combination with images from all over the broader Creole world, which will include Cuba and Haiti and Panama and Colombia, and they're all interwoven in a way so that you can see the visual similarities between these places and these cultures.
I can't wait for that. Now, Randy, you've done all kinds of things.
Yes, I went back to San Francisco, although a big part of my heart is still here. And who knows, I may come back. I expanded my focus. My interests have always been attempting to understand the dynamics of individual cultures. And San Francisco has that attraction for me. And after Elegance and Decadence, I did a book on Southern art. I did a book on Natchez. I did a guidebook to New Orleans called The Ultimate Guide to New Orleans, which I still think
wonderful
is
guidebook.
One of my best projects. And then I went back to California, and my newest book is on 5 great national parks around the world, 1 per continent. But it's not a travelogue. It is a beautiful book of beautiful photographs from many different sources. But my aim was to look at the challenges that national parks are facing around the globe. For me as a writer, the book has to push our culture forward. And that is the moral imperative of my work. And I have been very fortunate to be able to find ways to do that.
You two are a perfect pair, I have to say. We've been talking with Richard Sexton and Randolph Delahanty, creators of New Orleans Elegance and Decadence. They'll celebrate the 20th anniversary of their book with a new edition, Tuesday, October 8th from 6 to 7:30 at the Historic New Orleans Collection, 533 Royal Street. Free, but call 523-4662 to reserve a space. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Enjoy it.
Thank you, Susan. And thank you, New Orleans.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Errol Laborde signs Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival, Tuesday, October 8th from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Roger Kamenetz and Michael Hofka, sign To Die Next to You, Tuesday, October 8th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. The Historic New Orleans Collection presents today's guest, photographer Richard Sexton and writer Randolph Delahanty, celebrating the 20th anniversary of New Orleans Elegance and Decadence, Tuesday, October 8th from 6 to 7:30 at 533 Royal Street. Free, but call 523-4662 to reserve a space.
Delden McNeely signs Becoming, an introduction to Jung's concept of individuation, Wednesday, October 9th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop. Al Scrimuza, former owner and proprietor of Seafood City, discusses his role in local culinary history at 7 on Wednesday, October 9th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. That's part of the Culinary Legacy series hosted by Liz Williams, founder and president of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Carol Beauvais and Vincent Salucci will read their poetry Wednesday, October 9th at 8 in the UNO Liberal Arts Building, room 197. Father Tom Ryan discusses and signs his new book, Letters to the Romans, Thursday, October 10th at 5 at the Catholic Bookstore. Today's guest, Tim Parrish, discusses and signs Fear and What Follows, The Violent Education of a Christian Racist, and his novel, The Jumper, Thursday, October 10th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Garden District Bookshop presents Chuck Palahniuk's Adult Bedtime Stories, Thursday, October 10th at 8 p.m. at Tipitina's Uptown. Cult icon author Chuck Palahniuk, Fight Club, and Choke is debuting Doomed, the sequel to 2012's Damned, along with fellow writers Chelsea Kane and Monica Drake. Wear your jammies, bring your teddy bear. Tickets are available at Garden District Bookshop or Tips. Garrison Keillor appears and signs Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical, Vulgar, Pathetic, and Profound, Thursday, October 10th at 7 at the Jewish Community Center. Tickets are available at Garden District Bookshop. The Walker Percy Center at Loyola University presents its second biennial conference, Still Lost in the Cosmos, Walker Percy and the 21st Century. That's October 11th through 12th at Loyola University. Percy biographer Paul Eli is the keynote speaker Friday evening, and Tom Key presents Tom Key Gets Lost, based on Lost in the Cosmos, that Saturday evening. During the day, on Friday and Saturday, 42 panelists from all over the country will present 15 panels. Pre-register at loino.edu/WPC or at the door. Denise McConduit signs The Boy Who Wouldn't Read, Saturday, October 12th from 11:30 to 1:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship meets Saturday, October 12th from 2 to 4 at Metairie Park Country Day School's Bright Library. They'll be discussing David Copperfield, books 8 through 14. I'll be talking about my Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans at the Black Widow Literary Salon, Monday, October 14th at 6:45 at Crescent City Books. Catherine Brosman signs Louisiana Creole Literature, an Historical Study, Tuesday, October 15th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And October is National Reading Group Month for all you book clubbers out there. This is sponsored by the Women's National Book Association. WNBA NOLA will host four local events in partnership with the literary community over the next month. Alan Gerganis reads from Local Souls Tuesday, October 15th at 6 at Octavia Books. There will be a panel of mystery writers, Pamela Binning Jewin, Jean Redman, Erica Spindler, moderated by Antoinette de Alteras, Wednesday, October 16th at 7 at the Newcomb College Center for Research on Women. I'll be talking about my Book Lover's Guide to New Orleans Wednesday, October 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library, and Megan Holt will lead a discussion of Erna Broadbent's Louisiana, the One Book, One New Orleans Selection, October 24th at 6 at the Dillard Library Commons. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.